Thanks, Corey. Thanks. Let's say thanks to our team again one more time. Appreciate. I don't know about you, I love being led in worship like that, and especially when I'm called to sing words that I need to hear and I need to say. We're talking about the desert, and one of the important things in the desert is know that you're taken care of in the desert, because the desert's a hard place. If you're joining us for the first time, if this is your first time here, we're in this series around the desert, and we're talking about that, you know, as that metaphor of the places that are difficult for us. I was talking to a couple of friends of mine just over a week ago who are missionaries to Egypt, but they're actually home right now. They just had a baby and it was a preemie and they weren't able to go back right away. And I was just talking to them about when they're going back, because they're raising funds and the baby's at the point where Annika's her name. She's about ready to be able to go back. And I said, are you going back soon? And they said, well, we have a choice. We can either spend the summer in Michigan or we can spend the summer in the desert in Egypt. Which would you choose? Right? It's hot in the desert. In fact, I was listening and, you know, to Scott a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how hot it is in the desert, and I was interested in how hot and how cold it gets in the desert, because it's dangerous because it's so hot, but it can also be dangerous because it gets so cold. Do you remember, like, so there's snow again, right? It's January again in Michigan, but a week ago it did not feel like Michigan, did it? I got online and I was looking at the weather in the Sinai Desert and the weather in Jamestown, Michigan. And it was 9:15 on a Saturday night a week ago yesterday, and it was 50 degrees in Michigan. And it was 40 degrees in the Sinai Desert. Kind of strange. Huh? I mean, it's not what you think about, but there's these extreme temperatures in the desert, extreme hots, and then extreme colds, and it's dangerous. There's no shelter. And we use the desert as a metaphor for that, those difficult places in life that we hit, or that hit us, the things that happen to us in life. And most of us have been in the desert. If you haven't been in the desert, you're probably going to be there at some point in life. It's the place of drought, not much water. It's the place where you wonder how am I going to be protected? How am I going to be taken care of? It's the place we think of as the place of suffering. It's a hard place. It's a difficult place. When we think of the deserts of life, we often think of the worst things that happen in life. If you, hopefully you have some mentors in your life who are a little older. As I talk to the mentors in my life and I ask them about the deserts, they know what they are. And they can tell you about them. And they can tell stories about them. And they can talk about how they felt when they were in them. And talk about how they felt when they moved out of the desert. And one of the questions that we ask in the desert, all of us, we ask it, some of us ask it just for a little bit, some of us ask it for a long time and get stuck on the question, but we ask what I call the why question. God, why did this happen to me? How on earth did I get here? For most of us, we didn't choose the desert, although sometimes we make decisions that get us into the desert, but when bad things happen to us, or even evil things happen to us, hard things happen to us, we ask the question, why? Right? You've asked that question, I'm sure, before. I came across a quote by Dr. Martin Luther King, who he's dealing with this question. He says this. We're going to get back to here. Nope, Martin Luther King. We'll get there in just a second. Can you find it? It's one of the early slides. There we go. Good. Why, we ask, do these things occur if God is able to prevent them? This problem, namely the problem of evil, has always plagued the mind of man. I would limit my response to, I can't read the whole thing there, it's kind of stuck. I would limit my response to an assertion that much of the evil we experience is caused by man's folly and ignorance, and also by the misuse of his freedom. So what King is saying is that you and I are decision makers, right? We make decisions every day. We make choices every day. And what he's saying is that, you know, a lot of the things that happen to us in our lives, in fact, he uses the word much, not all, but much of the evil that we experience in life is a result of the choices that we make. Sometimes we're responsible. Or we can look out there and we can see who's responsible for the things that are happening. We know that someone made a bad decision or a sinful decision or an evil decision, whether it's in our family or whether it's something that's happening around the world. There's evil that's chosen by us as human beings. That's one answer to why we end up in the desert sometimes. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a Russian writer, and he was talking about some of the really horrible things that were happening in Russia. He wrote a book that some of you may have read in high school or in college called The Gulag Archipelago. And he writes this. He says, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. but the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. The reality is, we all make bad choices. We all, the word the Bible uses for it is sin. We all hurt ourselves and we all hurt other people. I won't make you raise your hand, but who's not a sinner here today? We all are. There's something that runs through us, and those choices, you know, we say to our kids all the time, you probably say this too, choices have consequences, right? Choices have consequences. So when we make bad or evil choices, we end up with bad and evil consequences. That's part of the desert. It's true, and it's often the result of decisions we've made. But it's not always true, is it? So why Dr. King uses the word much of the evil in the world. But it's not always true. The trouble is you can't always trace how this happened. How did I get here? The answer to that sometimes is, I don't know. I got pushed here. I got brought here. All of a sudden, this thing happened to me. Sometimes you can trace the evil to a decision that someone has made. Sometimes you can trace it to things that are in the culture. But other times, you can't find the necessary culpable person. But I like, I don't know about you, but I like to find where it came from, right? I wanna figure out, well, what happened here so we can avoid it in the future? I'm sure you're just like that too. And so that's why we ask the why question. Why did this happen to me? I was just talking to someone about 2 weeks ago, and he was telling me about some really rough things that were happening in his life. And he was talking about how he had been talking to his father about this, and his father said this to him. His father said, well, there must be some unresolved sin in your life that's causing these things to happen. Have you heard that? We ask the why question, and sometimes we get an answer that's not only not helpful, but I think it's actually bad theology. Although, so when I was a kid and I'm growing up and my parents were teaching me things, right? Teaching me right from wrong. Teaching me that if you do these things, these are the right things to do. And I kind of learned, probably like you did, that if I do the right things, good things will happen, right? If I do what's right, then good things will happen. In fact, as I became a Christian and I was trying to walk in, you know, the way that I was supposed to walk, I thought, well, if I do the right things and I follow Jesus and I give my heart to him and I give my life to him, then bad things won't happen to me, right? It's kind of like we like that equal sign. That's kind of how it's supposed to work. In fact, I think about the prosperity preachers on television. I would, and I really want it to be true. You know, I want to be able to send them $10 and become a millionaire. I really do. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way, at least not in the Bible that I've read. So I say it's bad theology that doing the right thing doesn't always end up in good things happening to us. And the bad things that happen to us, same thing, are not always a result of something that we specifically did. And so we're in the desert and we're stuck and we ask the question, why? Maybe we look and we go, well, I don't think I did anything. I don't think there's something that caused this. But yet I'm here in the drought, in the suffering. Some of you have been through some of these things, right? Why did I lose my job? I thought I was doing everything that I was supposed to do, and I tried to follow all the things that my boss said. Why did my husband leave me? I tried to love him well. I tried to meet his needs, and he left. Why was she at that intersection, at that moment? Because if it had been 5 seconds, 3 seconds, 1 second different, life would be different today. Why was he born with that disease? Why do these things happen? Why did beautiful, little, innocent kids who have done nothing yet in their lives, why are they born with rare diseases, and why are so many children around the world born into abusive families? And why are so many innocent children around the world born into families that that are living under poverty and can't feed them? Why, God, why? Because we can't trace it, right? We want to find what's happening and try to change it. One of the great human questions. It's okay to ask it. Why? Why, God? It's my question. I ask it. It's probably your question. Some of you are old enough to remember the book, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? By Harold Kushner. Some of you may have read that book. It's a kind of an old classic, asking the question about this, and a lot of people had wrestled with it, particularly when we're in the desert or slaves in Egypt. These are the stories that we're talking about in these couple of weeks, of the story of the people of Israel as they're slaves in Egypt, and they get released from being slaves in Egypt into what? The promised land? No. The desert, right? You ever thought about that? Slavery is kind of like a desert. Then they get released from a desert into another desert, right? A bad experience. We get out of it, and we end up in another bad experience. These are our questions. These are humanity's questions. We can't find the promised land. And I think this is why the story of the Exodus in the Bible is such a famous story. So maybe you're new to the Bible. Maybe you haven't been around Christianity before. Maybe you don't know these stories. But culturally, even a lot of people will know these stories because the story of the Exodus is a core story for not only the Jews, not only Christians, but also Muslims as well. So a huge portion of the population of the world has this as a core story. Why? I think it's because of that question, because we wrestle with the question, why? And we can trace some evil, we can trace some bad things in the world, but there are some disasters that happen around the world. There are some diseases that happen around the world. There are some circumstances that happen, and we can't trace it, and so we ask the question, why? Around the problem of evil. Why? Classically, it's been asked this way. Why? If God is powerful, and we just sang that he's powerful and that he's the king above all kings. He holds the world in his hands, I was told as a child. If that's true, if he's good, and if he's powerful, and if he holds the world in his hand, and he's the king of all things, why would God let these things happen to his people? That's the wrestling. That's one of the things that happens when we're going through the desert, is we wrestle with this question. So I want to, for those of you who maybe you don't know the Bible, maybe you haven't heard those stories, and I just, if you're new to this thing, we're really glad you're here, and I want to apologize because I'm covering a lot of territory this morning. And so if you don't know the story, I'm going to try to give you kind of an overview of the story, and I would love to have you go back and read it and hear it from the scriptures. But let me go back for you a little bit. Here's how kind of the story goes. There's a young man, I'm going to go way back for you, before this whole thing happens in Egypt in the desert. There's a boy named Joseph. And Joseph has a bit of a rift with his brothers, as we do, right? And his brothers, as they do, sell him off to slavery. That happened to you? No, probably not. Your brothers and sisters did other things. You thought you had it bad. But Joseph's brothers sell him off to slavery, and he ends up being bought by some people from Egypt. And he ends up in Egypt, far away from Palestine, and he ends up there, and a lot of things happen. I won't tell you the whole story, but he ends up actually doing well there, even though he was sold off. He ends up coming under the favor of the leaders there, and he actually moves through the ranks, and he becomes a major leader in Egypt. And what happens is back in Palestine, where his family's from, there's a famine in the land. So they go through their own desert. There's no water, and if there's no water, there's no agriculture. And if there's no agriculture, there's nothing on the dinner table. And so there's this huge, long drought. And so the people of Palestine make their way to Egypt because Egypt was doing well. And so they get to Egypt, and Joseph is there, and Joseph is in charge. And so Joseph actually saves his family. So that's how the story begins. And we love that story. I love that story. I'll speak for myself. I love that story, and here's why. Because there's an answer to the why question. Why did Joseph get sold by his brothers into slavery? Well, you may know this phrase if you've been around the church at all. God works all things together for good for those that love him, right? I like that verse, and I like it in this story because though Joseph went through his own desert, it ended up a good thing. Right, he saved his whole family and he saved everybody, not just his family, but all these people from Palestine. And so that's something good and we feel really good about it. But then the story goes on. So because all these people come from Palestine into Egypt, now you have all these Israelites who've left Palestine. They now live in Egypt. They've come there for the famine. They settle there and they don't end up going back home. And time passes. So here's how the book of Exodus begins. Exodus chapter 1. Says it this way. The Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Okay, so they left Palestine, they come to Egypt, they settle down, and they actually do pretty well. And they have babies, and they get jobs, and there's manufacturing, and they do all this stuff, and they're doing well, and they multiply. You know, as I was reading this story and thinking about this, I thought, you know, boy, there's nothing really new under the sun. Because what happens here is that Egypt all of a sudden doesn't like the fact that the Israelites are multiplying. So something happens, and the Egyptians get upset. In fact, here's how the story continues. Then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. We've had too many babies. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Rameses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. You see, there's nothing new under the sun. A group comes in, they're okay while they're a minority, but they start having babies and they start being successful, and now they're a problem. Now they're a problem. Now we need to enslave them. Now we need to do something about them. Do you think that the Israelites asked the why question? Here's the question I ask as I'm studying this and thinking about it. I wrote it down because I want to get it right. Why did God save Joseph to save his brothers, to give him favor in Egypt, to save his people, to prosper them during the famine, only to have them again become slaves? So God worked things to good, and then they didn't go so well anymore, right? Then things changed. And do you think the Israelites asked why? God, you've been faithful to us, but now we're slaves. Now we're working for the Egyptians. Now we're making bricks. Now we're being beaten for the things we're doing. Imagine, this is what it might feel like. You know, imagine the Native Americans when they were first slaughtered by some of the first settlers from Europe. Do you think they asked, why? What did we do? We were just living here. Imagine the African slaves who were torn from their homes, piled together in the prison bellies of the bottom of ships hauled across the Atlantic Ocean, to serve on plantations and in the homes of wealthy new landowners in this world? Do you think they asked, why us, why me? I was minding my own business with my family. That's the feeling, right? Why, God? Why did this happen? Imagine the Jews in Germany and Poland and all around Eastern Europe rounded up into train cars like cattle and sent off to prison camps. Why, God? What did we do? Did we had babies and we were successful? I mean, that's what the Exodus 1 says, right? The Israelites, they multiplied, and they were fruitful, and they did well. Bad people make bad choices, right? We started there. There's a new king, Exodus tells us. There's a new king in Egypt, and that king doesn't remember Joseph. And that king changes his mind, and his actions have what? Consequences. And so we can trace it a bit to this new king. It's the Pharaoh's fault. He's the culpable one, right? So the Israelites, if they're asking that question, maybe, why, God? Well, because of Pharaoh. Because of Pharaoh. So we're in this story of the desert. One of the key characters, if you're new to this, is Moses. And again, I'm not going to go into the whole story of Moses today, but Moses ends up trying to free his people. God asks Moses to go and free his people. We go through all this journey with Moses. He's with them through the desert, all of these things. Moses, at the end of this journey, writes some memories. So the book of Exodus, you know who the book of Exodus is written by? It's written by Moses, okay? Moses goes through the experience with the Israelites, and afterwards, or maybe during, he's taking some notes, he's writing, he's reflecting back on what happens. And I want to bring you on a journey with Moses because I think as Moses is looking back on this whole experience, he's asking some of the same questions that we would ask. Why, God? Why did all this happen? And so he looks back on this experience, and if you read, I'm not going to pull all these passages up this morning, but just share a couple of them with you. If you read back, there's three passages in which Moses is talking about this experience, and he says, when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he's talking about the plagues and stuff like that. I'm not going to go into all the detail. He hardened his heart and would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said. This is Exodus 8:15. Pharaoh, when Pharaoh saw what had happened, he hardened his heart, right? He made a decision, and his decisions have what? consequences. Pharaoh made a bad decision. Moses shares more about that. He says, but this time also, this is chapter 8 again, but this time also Pharaoh hardened his heart and would not let the people go. Pharaoh's making bad decisions, right? We can trace it. When Pharaoh saw that the rain and hail and thunder had stopped, another plague, he sinned again. He and his officials hardened their hearts. That's chapter 9, saying that Pharaoh's the culpable one, right? So why did the Israelites end up as slaves in Egypt after God had just rescued them? Why? It's Pharaoh's fault, right? Anybody feel better? We know who's at fault now? Except this Bible's not always that easy. That's three passages. So Moses is reading. He's reading back and he's thinking, how did this all happen? Why did this happen? Well, it's Pharaoh's fault. Except he writes some more. There are a few more passages. There are six passages in which the language is a little different. When Moses is writing, he says, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Well, by who? He doesn't say. It's almost as if Moses is looking back and saying, well, I don't know if Pharaoh chose this or if something happened. Here, I'll read a couple of them to you. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them. Do you know someone who has a hard heart? Maybe you know a little bit about their family situation. Maybe you know a little bit about what they went through. Yeah, maybe they chose some things, but maybe some things happened to them. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is unyielding. Pharaoh's heart became hard. Pharaoh's heart was hard. His heart was unyielding. Pharaoh's heart was hard. Those are six times, if you're an English person, you know that who's the actor? Who's making Pharaoh do this? So it feels a little bit to me like Moses is looking back and saying, well, no, Pharaoh did it. Well, actually, maybe it wasn't Pharaoh's fault. Maybe some things happened. I'm not sure why. And here's the problem. He goes one step further as he writes the story. Three times he says it's Pharaoh's fault. Six times he says, well, his heart was hardened. Nine times Moses says, well, maybe it was God. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. He says several times, 5 times God says these words, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. It's as if Moses is looking back and he's asking the why question, like you and I do because we're human. And he's asking the question, why? Well, it's somebody's fault. Actually, I don't know whose fault it is. Actually, maybe it's God's fault. I mean, have you ever been there? You ever been in the desert and you feel like, maybe my Sunday school teacher wouldn't be happy, but I'm really mad at God? I think he did this. I think God is culpable. It's as if Moses is struggling with this question. Now, I don't mean to confuse you about your Bible. That's not my intention. I think Moses, like you and I, is human, and I think he's confused, and I think he's struggling with the why question. Why did this happen to the Israelites? Why did this happen to me? I mean, I was just kind of minding my own business, and all these things happened to me. So here's, make a little turn for you now. We all ask the question, why? We all ask the question of the problem of evil, and I think that the why question misses the point. I think the why question misses the point. You have to ask it. I have to ask it. It's a part of being human, and it's okay, but I think it misses the point, and it actually doesn't end up being helpful. Maybe it's a part of the grief process, but have you ever noticed this? God never answers Moses' questions. Why me, God? When he meets God at the burning bush, why do you want to send me, God? God doesn't answer that question. Do you think Moses had these questions? If you know his story, Moses was abandoned at birth. God, why did I get abandoned at birth? Why did I have to grow up in a different household? Why did I have to wander in the desert? Why did you harden Pharaoh's heart? Why did you have to, in all of the plagues, why didn't the first plague work? Why did you have to go all the way to killing the firstborn? I mean, I'll never be able to answer that question. Why did we have to eat unleavened bread in the desert? Why couldn't you have sent Panera? Right? Why? I know I made some mistakes in the desert, God. I know I hit the rock and I threw down the tablets. But man, it was hard. It was 40 years and I lost my temper a couple times. Really, why couldn't I at least walk into the promised land before I died? I know you forgave me. But why couldn't I at least see the promised land? You see, for Moses, I'm sure he had the questions. I'm sure the questions were real. I'm sure the suffering was real. The slavery was real. The oppression was real. But I'm not sure that the why question was helpful. So as I close, I want to give you two things that I think might be helpful. You're going to ask the why question. It's normal and it's okay. And your friends are going to ask the why question. And let me just say this, for those of you who have friends who are going through the why question, two things. One, please don't tell them it's because of something they did and a sin that happened to them. It's not helpful. In fact, it's hurtful. Many, many people I've met with have left the church because their Christian friends have said those things. Secondly, let them ask the question and don't have anxiety over answering it. If God doesn't answer it, you don't have to answer it. It's not about answering the why question. Let me give you two things that I think might be helpful. The first one has to do with one of the early commandments. Scott actually shared this in the first week on the desert. It's from Deuteronomy chapter 6. It's after they get out of slavery and then up in the desert, and God is kind of saying, okay, here's how we're going to function together, and let me share some things with you. And he gives this command. Some of you might remember this from the first week. In the future, when your son asks you, what is the meaning of the stipulations, decrees, and laws the Lord our God has commanded you? Okay? Tell him, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Before our eyes, the Lord set signs and wonders, great and terrible, on Egypt and Pharaoh and his whole household. But he brought us out from there to bring us in and give us the land he promised on oath to our ancestors. Now, leave that up. I want you to notice something. This is like me asking my mom when I'm a little kid, well, why should I obey the rules? Well, because you're going to be blessed by it, right? And when you don't obey the rules, that's not what this says. What this says is, why should we obey the rules? Because God saved you. Because God saved us. Because God did amazing stuff for us when we were slaves. Because God did these things for us when we couldn't take care of ourselves. That's why. It's not because if you do them, then the right things will happen. It's because God is who he is. I want you to follow him because of who God is. Instead of asking the why question, here's the first one. Instead of asking the why question, remember. Instead of asking why, remember. You see, there are stories in our past when God has shown up, when God has saved us. And if you don't have those stories, then maybe some of your friends have those stories, or maybe your people have those stories, or that's part of the purpose of the scriptures is to remind us, to tell us the stories so that we can remember. Elie Wiesel, who was in a concentration camp during World War II and has written a lot about suffering, wrote this in his Nobel Peace lecture. He said, remembering is a noble and necessary act. The call of memory, the call to memory, reaches us from the very dawn of history. No commandment figures so frequently, so insistently in the Bible. It is incumbent upon us to remember the good we've received and the evil we have suffered. Remember, God says. Remember. Remember what I did for you. You remember what I did for your people. And if you don't remember, then talk to people who remember. Tell the stories when your son asks you. Tell him the stories. You see, on the night before Jesus was arrested, before he was beaten and before he was taken to the cross, Jesus shared a meal with his disciples that was called the Passover meal. And it was a meal about them being saved from the Egyptians. It's remembering this. And Jesus is remembering in that Passover meal. And for those of you who, again, who've been in the church for a while, you'll hear these words. Each time that you eat of this bread, do so what? Remembrance of me and what I've done. Each time that you drink of this cup, do so in remembrance of me. The call, the command is to remember. Remember when it doesn't feel like God is there, when it doesn't feel like he shows up, when you're asking the why question, remember that God is the one who saves you. You see, God is asking you to trust in him for the future because of what he's done in the past. Catch that? God is trusting you in the middle of the desert to trust that there's another side out of the desert. Trust him for the future because of what's done in the past. You see, hope for the future comes from remembering the past. Hope is worthless if we have nothing to base it on. And what the Bible is saying is listen to the stories of the past so that you have hope for the future. Hope is about remembering. So first, instead of asking why, remember. For the second one, I'm going to take you to the beginning of the story. So that's kind of after they end up in the desert, early on in the story, Exodus chapter 3, God comes to Moses in the desert while the people are slaves in Egypt. And God says this to Moses. He says, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them. So the first is, instead of asking why, remember. But the second is, instead of asking why, ask who. This is the God we serve. You see, in the desert, can we go back to that scripture a minute? Notice this scripture. This is a God who sees you. When you're there in the desert and you're asking the why question and you're suffering, he sees you. And when you're crying out and you're asking the why question, well, why me? Why is this happening? This hurts so bad. I'm suffering so bad. He says, I hear you crying. When you're in that spot and you're weeping and you're hiding from everybody else and you just can't hold it together anymore and everything falls apart, your God hears your cries. He is a good, good Father. Because he sees you. And he hears you. And you notice the next one? And he is concerned about you. He cares about you. His heart breaks for you when he sees you and he hears you crying out. And he doesn't just see and hear and feel, but what does he do? What's the end of that say? So I will come down. That is powerful. When you're in the desert and you're feeling alone, you feel like you have no way out and you're suffering and you're crying out and you're saying, God, why? God sees you and he hears you and he feels you and he comes down. The story, the remembering story that we tell over and over and over again, the good gospel that we want to share with you this morning, wherever you're coming from, is that the story of God, the story of the Bible is God seeing and hearing and feeling his suffering people and coming down. You see, Christmas is all day long, all year long, all the time as a Christian. The incarnation, the coming of Jesus. We sing songs like Emmanuel, God with us. That is the story of the gospel. God is always with us. The answer to the why question is that God is here. Throughout the Bible, people like you and I have asked the question, why God? And when Noah asked the question, why? He didn't get an answer to that question, but here's what he did get. I'm your God, and I'm with you. And when Abraham went through the things that Abraham went through, he said, why, God? And God said, I'm with you, and I'm your God. And when Jacob was struggling, Jacob cried out to God, and God said, I'm with you, and I'm your God. And when Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, and I'm sure he cried out, why, God? God didn't answer the question why, but he said, I'm with you, and I'm your God. And when Moses and the Israelites cried out, and they said, why, God? Why are you doing this? He didn't answer that question, but he said, I'm with you, and I'm your God. And when Job lost everything, and his entire family, and all his resources, and everything, he cried out to God, and for chapter, if you've ever read the book of Job, chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter, he asks why, and God never answers the question why, but he does say this, I am with you and I am your God. And when Jesus Christ hung on the cross to give his life for you and I, he said, why, God, have you forsaken me? And God didn't answer the question why, but he said, I am with you and I am your Father and I am your God and I see you and I hear you and I feel you and I will come down. What is the good news this morning? You might feel alone. You might feel rejected. You might feel like you're stuck in the desert. You might be suffering. You might be crying out to God. You might feel abandoned. You're not alone. You're not abandoned. God is the God who sees and hears and feels and comes. And I want to tell you today, I want to promise you today, and I'll tell you story after story. You want to stay here with me this afternoon? I'll tell you story after story in the Bible. And I'll tell you story after story of people I know. I'll tell you story after story from my life that God shows up in the desert. Remember who this God is and what he has done. I want to invite you into three things this morning. I'm going to invite the band to come back up. I want to invite you into three things this morning. The first invitation I want to give you is an invitation into the presence of God. Because I've asked this question as I studied the desert, as I wrestled with this message. I asked the question, why did the Israelites have to wander in the desert for 40 years? it's not that big. It's not that far. From Egypt to the promised land is not that far. It doesn't take 40 years. Why? I think they didn't see the presence of God right there, right with them. Sometimes we can be doing this. We can be crying out, but we've got our eyes covered, and God is saying, I'm right here with you. So I want to invite you to press in this morning into the presence of God. The second invitation is how. How do I do that? Well, one of the ways I want to invite you to do is I want to invite you to sing. Now, some of you maybe came to church and you're like, I'm not a singer. I don't sing. I sound terrible. I feel awkward. I want to invite you because there's something that happens to us when we invest our bodies in something and not just our minds. We invest our bodies and we vocalize things. That's why the scripture constantly calls us to sing. It changes us. And so I want to invite you, as you're going to sing some words you might not even believe right now. But the truth is that the Lord sees you and the Lord hears you and the Lord feels what you're feeling. And he has come down. And so I want to invite you to sing. And the last thing I want to invite you to is I want to invite you to believe the impossible. There's a psalm that says that there is a river with streams that make glad the city of God. And when you're in the desert, you need to hear that. There's hope. There are streams that bring joy and gladness in the city of God. In the desert, you're longing for it and you're thirsty and there's a drought. And to believe that hope, you have to believe that God has shown up in the past. And let me just ask, can I just ask this congregation right now? Has God ever shown up for you? He has. I know he has. And some of you are like, I don't know. I don't believe it. He's not going to show up for me now. I want you to lean on our faith. I have leaned on other people's faith many, many times when I didn't have it because they remembered for me. And I want to invite you to believe the impossible. There is a stream that makes glad the cities of God. There is a way out of slavery. There is a way through the desert, and there is a promised land. But it requires remembering not only what God has done, but trusting that God is who he says he is. When Moses asked him, "Who are you?" He says, I am who I am, and I have shown up. My prayer for you this morning is that God will show up, that you feel his presence as you lean into it this morning. I want to invite you into worship.